Ladies and gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Monday edition. Today's date is Monday, January 21st, 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. We are coming to you live and direct from France and Britain and Sweden, in fact. We've got a three-way link going on right now. Technology is not perfect. The quality of our broadcast today is going to be less than perfect, as usual. We've had problems with the audio side of our effort. We've had the ability to make multi-party calls stopped on our phones. Why, we don't know. We've called phone company about it. I tried getting it on my phone, and it wouldn't work here either, and we don't know why. What we do know is that there are always alternate technologies, and some of them not as good as others. So when we can't use one, we use the other, and we kind of hope that it's listenable and that you're going to get something out of this broadcast. Of course, if you're watching any news today, you're understanding that the world's financial system is coming apart at the seams. The wheels have come off the cart, ladies and gentlemen, as I had predicted back in November. And, of course, being rare at the job here of actually putting a date to events, because I had been wrong so many times. I told you so many times in these broadcasts that picking timing this stuff is very difficult, because I'm not the person in charge of pulling the levers of power, so I don't know when things are really going to happen, but I certainly know what is happening. Now, here's the thing. The people who have had their hands on the levers of power are also losing control over the events. And things are happening in their own time frame, not at their urgings any longer. And their plunge protection team that they've got built in the United States and in London is failing to stop the cascading effect of financial problems around the world. Why? Because nickel and dime investors, as well as small investment houses around the world, are beginning to see the folly in trying to prop up an American financial system that is built on fraud, graft, waste, and inflation. And they know that the future of the American economic structure is completely defunct, and therefore they're beginning to balk at any future or further investment. Now, that doesn't mean their governments haven't participated in the fraud, Singapore and other places. But the fact is even with these huge infusions of $50 billion and $75 and $100 billion of money coming into the system, they can't prop this up anymore. It's, again, as Mohammed Rafik once said, it's Humpty Dumpty, ladies and gentlemen, and we cannot put him back together again. So I'm going to bring up Mohammed right now because we're going to do another installment here of the continuing nightmare of world finance. Mohammed, are you with me?
I am indeed, Dale. Can you hear me?
I can hear you quite well. Mohammed, you know, you were privy to to today's drops because you were involved in doing some other things. But once I talked to you earlier and said to you, we're talking about 8%, 9%, and 10% drops on certain indices around the world. These are some of the largest single-day drops in market history. We're talking drops that automatically start having stops put on the activity because, I mean, you know, that's free fall. A 10% drop in any major market is a free fall, is it not?
Absolutely. It's a massive pop. And, in fact, some of the drops today have actually been worse in magnitude than October 1987, the infamous Black Monday. where we ended up, and of course what happened there, Dal, and which is highly likely to happen here, is that it's going to roll on for another 2 or 3 days, because it went off by about 4 or 5% the first day back then, and by the end of the week it had closed down a total of about 30 to 40% off the FTSE.
Well, and you know, last week in the U.S. markets, the jitters, and then the nonsensical solution that Bush came up with of handing out more debt-based, debased currency to the plebiscite as a way of massaging the public, and of course, $150 billion in today's terms. This is just a couple of hours printing over at the Fed. It's nonsense, and it's not going to do a darn thing except to create more inflation, which is actually going to hasten the demise of the economy, is it not?
Well, not only is it going to have the mathematical effect now, but it's also, like you pointed out, it's having the psychological effect. These small investors and the small brokerage houses, they're watching the Bush-Bernanke-type solution, and they're saying, hold on a minute, all you guys are doing is just printing more money. And, you know, we put up with the first $50 billion, then $75 billion, then $45 billion, then, and all these different windows that they've opened. To turn around and just add on to that another $150 billion, everybody who's anybody on the professional investment circuit, even the small guys, the little guy you're talking about, they know this is ultimately inflationary. So even before the inflation effects percolated through, which, as you've rightly pointed out, is difficult to estimate, especially given the amount of manipulation in the market, but what it has done, it's had an immediate psychological impact on people.
Yep.
They've just said, oh, if this is the only solution that you're going to keep providing, it's like having gangrene in the leg, and what they're doing is they're giving painkiller, painkiller, and yet more painkiller. To anybody looking on, even not necessarily members of the medical profession, they're going to say, look, you know, all right, the guy isn't feeling any pain, but you're not treating the gangrene. All you're doing is relieving the symptom of pain. We're not actually dealing with the sickness here. And
what that portends is a death of the system. Now, let's talk for a second about the default swap and default derivatives here. This is where this is the most recent failure in the market. These companies that have been underwriting the default swaps in an insurance status. In other words, when you make a swap or you make a derivative default derivative swap with somebody, you're buying a position that has an implied insurance to it, and the insurance companies of these default swaps and derivatives have been downgraded. The companies that are doing the propping up of these investment vehicles don't have the money to back their insurance.
Well, of course, in fact, in the industry, Darrell, you're quite right to use the term insurance. In the industry, we sometimes use the colloquial term credit insurance for a credit default swap. It is also known as taking out credit insurance. And ultimately, as with all forms of insurance, there is an insuring entity, the one who's actually, for the premium, is prepared to make the payout. And what's happened is a lot of these companies, we discussed this previously, Darrell, that all the lending that was going on last month and the month before that, and these strange windows and intergovernment, you know, a bank like UBS borrowing from a national government because it's in such a big mess, it's used up its windows, as they call them, inside of the Swiss Central Bank. It can't get any more credit there. It can't get credit lines anywhere else. What they were doing then, Darrell, of course, was, as I explained to the audience out there, is that they were just borrowing to remain solvent, to meet the solvency ratios.
Well, not only that, they also had some people who were on the right side of some of these transactions who needed to be satisfied in the short term so that they could remain, at least on the surface, a viable enterprise. In other words, if people are ponying up and saying, hey, wait a minute here, I want my payout, and they're not paying out, that means that they have automatically put themselves in an insolvent position. So they were taking care of their most aggressive requirements, but it was all window dressing. Yes.
Well, there's two elements to it. One is the bank solvency ratios or capital ratios, where they actually have to maintain ratios of capital for solvency purposes to actually remain legally active as a bank or financial institution. And that's what they were borrowing for last month. What we're looking at now in phase two is the bigger problem. As you're pointing out, Noel, the bigger problem is, okay, they've managed to balance the books so that as a bank they're currently solvent. They've borrowed from the Singapore government or whatever. So they're not out of business, but they now have to also borrow to pay the people they owe money to. That's the second phase of borrowing, i.e. some of these people, like you say, are on the right side of these credit default swaps. We saw some people who'd taken some bets at the usual suspects, Goldman, on the subprime market collapsing, and they made $4 billion on those bets. The fact is, though, Dow, you know, in the law of markets, somewhere somebody has lost $4 billion to them and is got to pay up. They've got to pony up. So we're on the second round now of borrowing, where the central banks, the Fed, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, whatever, are now being asked to lend to these institutions, not to keep them solvent, but to pay the people that they owe money to. And, of course, they're now looking at the scores on the doors and realizing, hey, these numbers are as big as our capital requirement, maybe even bigger than the capital requirement. We've got to borrow even more just to pay these people. We told people, didn't we, Dow, back in December, that the Northern Rock exercise was nothing to do with saving Rock, that taxed Northern Rock, the 20 odd billion pounds that was put into that. It was actually to make sure that they didn't bother for capital purposes. They gave to Northern Rock so Northern Rock alone could pay the people it owed money to so that it didn't cause credit collapse in that area.
That's right. So what we had was Northern Rock funneled that money, that 25 billion pounds or almost $50 billion, to correspondent banks that had transactions within their portfolio structure so that those. So basically what they did is they used Northern Rock as a funnel to receive funds to other banks like Abbey National and Barings and the rest, so that these people would have a short-term fix on all of the demand that was coming out of their off of their balance sheets. Now, but here's the big rub, and we got to move the ball forward here to today. The amount of swaps that have already gone bad are $2.1 trillion. This is just as of today, and the knock-on effect of these failures is going to be in the multi-trillions again. Now, $2.1 trillion just on the derivative swaps, which is the insurance against this. This was folly from the beginning, Mohammed, and you know, having been in the profession, when you're buying a derivative swap as an investment, you're saying that, you know, if you're buying insurance on it through a company, let's say, Ambec, or what's the other one there, MBIA, or one of these others, basically you're saying, if the whole market melts down, I'm going to get some of my money back. But look, if the market melts down, money doesn't have any value anyway. What are they going to pay you with? It's going to be like the Weimar Republic or something, where okay, 10 years ago your Weimar was worth a loaf of bread, but today 10 million Weimarks are worth a loaf of bread. The value is in what it could buy. Now, we're at a point right now where the whole idea of these credit rating insurances was a fraud to start with, and I'll tell you why I think so. Because the only way that you were going to ever see payment on that is if the financial system melted down, and if it melted down, there was no value there anyway. Well, so these derivatives were being traded with absolutely no basis in reality. In other words, it was a fraud.
There were many elements to it which, in the credit rating industry, that were fraud or false. There were many elements. Some of it was just in assumptions. The strange thing is now that when these credit ratings are assigned, what a lot of people are looking at is the idea of counterparty risk and not systemic risk.
Right.
So what they're saying is, if this counterparty fails, then I've insured against counterparty failure. Of course, when we start looking at contagion with credit risk and systemic risk, where it becomes system-wide and you get system-wide failure, the whole thing falls apart. It only works if a single company goes bust and it pays out then. But in practical terms, what's happening now is there is a meltdown because of the obligations to pay, which I'll cover in a moment the central banks have engineered some of that. We'll discuss that at the moment. But what they're doing is they've engineered everything so that only a single company would fail, or maybe a couple of companies fail here and there. And these insurance companies, just like any other insurance company, they work out how much they think they're going to pay out in a year, and then they make premiums that are higher than that so that they're left with a bit at the end. When systemic risk comes in, when the markets melt down as they are doing, none of it works. The whole game is off.
Well, do you remember when Greenspan was in about 8-10 years ago, one of the majors in the bond market failed, and it failed because of graft and corruption, and they were some of the usual suspects involved in this implosion. And the bond rating system that was guaranteeing the solvency of this particular company failed, and the Fed had to step in with an overnight loan to these people just to stop the implosion from others. In other words, they saw the immediate risk to the system because this – what was the name of the company? And it finally ended up failing, but – well, it was a big scandal back in the 90s. Jesus.
It was LTCM, Long-Term Capital Management.
That's right. That's the one. And what happened with these people was that these people knew darn well that a single company failure did have systemic risk. Well, go ahead.
Well, one of the things which is fraudulent in credit ratings is the fact that LTCM was a AAA-rated institution. It had two Nobel Economic Laureates on the advisory committee who'd come up with this incredible strategy, macro strategy for making vast amounts of money out of the world. In the end, when the whole thing was analysed, it was like one big bet. It was insane the way that the whole thing was structured in the end. But loads of banks went in through the back door. One of the banks that I was working at the time, I shan't mention the name, but they'd already put a lot of money in. They went, a couple of the directors from this global bank went in through the back door and gave them $100 million to help them out. Lots of other banks went in and helped them out through the back door because of systemic risk. AAA-rated bank or institution, in this instance, failing, everybody started losing confidence. So because they bailed it out and it didn't really fail, what happens is that when we look at the probability of failure for AAA-rated institutions, they've got some probability down that's like one in every 204 years. But LTCM failed within the last 10 years. Baring failed within the last 20 years. So actually, the probability is far higher. All the subsequent probabilities for AA, single A are all based on ratios and the relative factors to each other in the credit ratings, the different kinds. It's a type of correlation.
So you're saying to me, because Long-Term Capital Management was bailed out and it didn't technically fail, their models for risk of AAAs didn't get changed when it should have, because basically what they were looking at is of course systemic risk from Long-Term Capital Management, and as a result it would have changed the entire credit rating model, which would have caused every one of these other companies to have a different ratio of asset on balance sheet. And because they couldn't do that, what they basically did was that the federal government came in and bailed them out in an overnight window deal that everybody tried to keep quiet.
Yep, that's exactly it, Darrell. And what happened was, as you quite rightly pointed out, the statistics have been wrong ever since. So that things like that have added fuel to the current fire, because we have systemic risk. We've got Barclays that were insolvent. They borrowed to maintain solvency, but now the people that Barclays owed money to are saying, when are we going to get paid out? Now, we warned people about Northern Rock that it was not a solvency issue. They weren't trying to keep the institution afloat. It was a payment on. Now going to give, and we were the only people who said that anywhere publicly in the world, Darren. It only came out through the French connection. We're now going to tell people through the French connection something else which is going on. Barclays, UBS, a lot of big banks owe money to the other banks because they were on the losing side of these bets. What's actually happened is that the central banks have gone round to their creditors and said, listen, guys, don't lean too heavily. We're sorting out the solvency. Once they've sorted out the solvency, we're going to put together some kind of prepayment structure whereby you'll get your money back, albeit it might take 15 or 20 years because you're owed that much. In the meantime, in order to keep the traders quiet in the institutions that have made the money, so the guys at Goldman who've made that billion, they are looking at a bonus maybe of 10%. So between the three of them, they're sharing $300 million. So what's happened is that we pay Goldman the $300 million so that the traders get paid out, and that way they remain silent. And what's happened is that the central banks, the Fed, the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, have ordered all the commission and bonus elements of those payments to be paid out so that everybody stays quiet.
Well, now here's the next leg of the table to come out, and it's these rating companies. Now, let's talk for a minute about Moody's. We can talk a little bit about MBIA. We can talk about what's some of the other ones here, the AMBEC. What's the one here? Listen to this one. They're getting loans from Warburg Pincus, it says here, to keep MBIA up. And MBIA is another rating agency, which was downgraded. No, Fitch downgraded AMBEC, which here's the pot calling the kettle black, if I ever saw it, that the Fitch rating agency, of course, is sitting on top of all kinds of math formulas that they're sharing with their correspondent companies that do business with Fitch, saying that this is a AAA, this is that rated, this is junk rated, blah blah blah. And the fact of the matter is three quarters of the AAAs out there are junk and worse. Some of them are completely insolvent, but they're still sitting on books as AAA. And then Fitch has the audacity to go out and say that AMBEC, which is another rating agency, is insolvent. So what is AMBEC going to do? Come back and say Fitch is insolvent either? I mean, come on. The whole thing is all done. It's toast. It's Humpty Dumpty, as you've said before.
Yeah, the destruction levels within the financial game are so great that, I mean, the amount of money, if you just look at what UBS has borrowed from the Bank of Singapore and what Barclays has borrowed from the Fed, you realize that, you know, to repay those debts over time, and you look at what the profit margin, I think, was it $41 billion that Barclays borrowed off the Fed? It was $41 billion, wasn't it? That was it.
That's right.
So let's assume that Barclays' annual profits, I think, is declared are about $3 billion, $6 billion. Even if they diverted all of their profits for the next 8 years, it's got to be 8 years before they can pay the Fed back. And that's diverting every single penny that they make. In practical terms, they probably can afford to put 25 to 30%. So the Fed can, the American taxpayer can look forward to receiving that money back within the next 30 years.
And now, wait a minute. Now, what is the hyperinflation of the dollar do to the repayment schedule of the loans being made? Because are these being given in inflation-adjusted terms, or are they being given in a single constant-term money, so that if they hyperinflate the economy, the money being paid back is less valuable? You know what I'm getting to here.
That's a very interesting question, that, Darrell. One of the things about these mischievous windows, as they're called, which appear in the Fed for taxpayers' money, U.S. taxpayers' money, is that the windows are outside all normal rules of financial engagement. Yeah. So basically, they don't declare what the terms are. We don't understand the terms of the loan. They're not publicly declared, nor are there is there a legal mechanism to find out what they are. I suspect, and it's quite disgusting but true, I suspect that some of these may have even been interest-free loans.
Just short-term plugs to stop the dike from squirting here. Now, why Singapore and why Saudi Arabia? Is it because they hold sway over these two governments? Of course, we know Singapore is a city-state. It's not a nation. It's as big as San Diego, California, basically. But they're still sitting on top of a pool of cash coming in out of the oil off their coast and off their business dealings. You know, that's always been a big haven for tax-free investment and a very progressive criminal capitalist state. Now, is it because they hold sway over this arm of their organization? I know that they do in the Saudi capital. You know, while suburbs and slums in Riyadh are not eating, the Saudi government's handing out $100 billion.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Saudi government can afford to lend out $100 billion because it's small potatoes to them. They own, I believe it's 20% of the U.S. stock market. Their stock market ownership is valued at $800 billion. They're very, very wealthy people. And with Singapore, of course, HP, Compaq, and a lot of the big hardware manufacturers in the U.S., started a superconductor corridor in Singapore, and they did a lot of their research and manufacture out there. All the HP handhelds, Compaq handhelds, a lot of other famous manufacturers from the States like Dell did Singapore manufacturing throughout the entire boom time of the e-bubble. And so Singapore actually got a huge amount of cash as a result of that. Again, as you say, Dale, it was all through tax-free incentives and things like that. But they drew the money in and they got a stock of cash. When it comes to these windows, Dale, although the windows have been opened under the pretext of a short-term plug, because we don't understand the terms, and a lot of these terms are verbal, I believe that Barclays have actually been told you can have that money for the next 20 years and pay us back $2 billion a year rather than pay us back rapidly. Because Barclays don't have that kind of money. They can't afford to borrow $41 billion because they haven't got $41 billion to pay back. The bank's not worth that much.
Well, now, here's the second question. If, in real terms, they're bankrupt, along with Citibank in America, is gone, finished. I mean, it's a shell of what it was, and basically smoke and mirrors and chewing gum are holding the thing together. We've got all the rating agencies going belly up here. We've got one of them gone from AAA to double, and that's a farce because it's probably insolvent as well. We've got major brokerage firms and trading houses that are gone belly up because they've been on the wrong side of these swaps. We're looking at a systemic and worldwide failure of the financial system, and we're going to start seeing runs on banks. And we already saw the beginnings, the rumblings of a run with Northern Rock, and that's nothing compared to what will happen with a Citibank failure or with a HSBC failure or with what the holdings in the Hutchinson Whampoa are in the Orient. When you start seeing worldwide failure happening in the financial structure, it's what's going to happen is that money becomes valueless, and what is valuable are the things that money has bought you in the past, not what it's going to buy you in the future. So can we talk a little bit about this period of transition here? I don't see the financial system being saved here.
It's not possible to save the financial system. I've repeatedly stated that. What's actually broken is a set of mathematical formula which can't be wound back, can't possibly predict into the future because it's like the Mandelbrot set, it's like fractal mathematics. We don't know what's going to happen there. It's extremely unpredictable. The other thing is that the confidence at the bottom level, George Bush's latest $150 billion print It just made everybody say, oh, come on, when are you actually going to do something that's going to make a difference? We did tell people, Darrell, again, that there was an opportunity for a sensible interest rate movement at the beginning of December, which would have been enough to kick-start the December sales, the Christmas sales. The government failed to take that opportunity. In doing that, they've hastened the collapse of retail.
Which lends the question, this lends the question of, are they now, you mentioned, and I think I'm on board with this, that they hadn't got this time frame in their planning. But now that the thing has started to come apart and their experts have looked at it and said, look, this is not fixable, let's just get on the closest side to right that we can and just pull the plug.
Absolutely.
And right. And I think the plug was this. Now, the plug got pulled last week. Now, if you take a look at people running for exits during the midweek trading all the way into Friday in the U.S. markets, and it was mostly capital transfers and the international capital markets that were really starting to rumble. Now you take a look on Monday, and you see 8% and 9% stock drops, stock market drops, and of course, that's the beginning because it was. This doesn't look good to me. This looks like, you know, we're going back to the dark ages. I mean, you know, we're going to have to hunker down here. If you're Muhammad, if you're living in a central city and your $1,000 that you got paid last week can't go out and buy your family food for the month, there's going to be some problems here. I don't know what's going to happen, but it is not good. I have no way of knowing what's going to happen next, and I don't think anybody does. How do these crazy buggers that did this, finally pulling the plug, what are they planning on in your view?
What we predicted, they're having to go with it because it's unfixable. It's wrong in their timescales, but they were ultimately planning to try and do something similar to this, and they're saying, hey, it's the perfect storm, let's try and go with it. What we said last month, Darrell, was we said that if you don't rescue retail, then after the collapse of retail, wholesalers will fall apart, manufacturers, and then industrial. So there's actually four industry groups that will collapse if you don't actually get the sales up in December. And they didn't. And what's happened in January? The largest retailers in Europe are all posting the lowest in record December sales. And that means that the other things that we predicted, maybe 1 to 2 months, that standard predictable stuff, 1 to 2 months, the wholesalers will be moaning. 1 to 2 months after that, it'll be the distribution and manufacturers. 1 to 2 months after that, it'll be the industrials.
Now, you want to hear the funniest thing? On top of all this news coming out of the markets are dropping like a stone, the French television channels all start saying Al-Qaeda is going to attack Paris. I'm telling you, no joke, it's an Al-Qaeda plot, and we're all going down the tubes. And somebody said to me as I was doing some errands today, did you hear about the terrorist attack? And I said... And they said, do you think it's real? Because these people trust my opinion. And they said, do you think it's real? And I said, well, the warnings are coming from the people who are probably going to be doing it to you. So, yeah, I take it seriously. And the person looked at me and didn't know what I meant.
Yeah.
What do you mean the warnings are coming from the people who are going to do it? This woman didn't get it. And finally, when it dawned on her, she said, like... I was being a little bit flippant with her, and finally when it dawned on her, you know, she's like, really? And I'm like, yeah. You know, the Sarkozy and co. And the Israeli connection and the rest of it, these people are going to be working overtime for the next few weeks trying to create, the Arabs did it, and the Persians did it.
Yeah, well, they usually try to turn to a distraction. The interesting thing is... without trying to go into racial stereotypes at all, right now there's an enormous amount of focus by the other side because they realize that the financial collapse is unstoppable What they're trying to do, as you said, is get on the right side of it. So they're quite taken time-wise, the serious players, because some of them I know for a fact have been caught. NM Rothschild Bank in London has been absolutely hammered. And, you know, if Mr. Rothschild wasn't such a wealthy man, one could almost feel sorry for him. But they've been absolutely hammered, and the bank that they were partnering with, that they were planning to take over, largest Dutch bank, they've now had to back down from that purchase because they can't afford to do it. And the Dutch bank has approached the Royal Bank of Scotland asking if they can afford to. And because the Royal Bank of Scotland didn't do any derivatives trading, they can. And that's now going forward. But NM Rothschild basically have taken a massive hammering. They were one of the companies, incidentally, that really pushed hard derivative trading and believed in it, because they really knew this was a way to get round the bank capital restrictions and print money like there's no tomorrow. They've obviously taken a massive exposure on it and a massive hit, and we wonder what kind of deals are being done behind the doors to keep the Rothschild name afloat in London at the moment. We don't hear about that, of course, because it's still a privately owned bank. When Barclays go to the Fed, it has to be declared publicly because it's a public limited company, and the affairs of its accounts are in the public domain. And NM Rothschild is actually privately owned. In fact, it's the trading name, or it's not even a limited liability company, Dal, it's the trading name. It's Mr. Rothschild trading as, so he actually doesn't declare any accounts to anybody, I mean by that an accounting public body or the company's house, within the UK at all. It's an entirely private institution, still sole trader.
Well, you know, the same is true of some of these trust arrangements the Warburgs have put together with this Pincus guy, because we know Pincus was one of the... He was one of the people floating around before World War One. The Pincus family. There was a big. What was the guy in Pincus there? Jesus, he was a. He had another name he was running under. And but their whole family, of course, the monies are not being declared as far as what they own and what they control.